This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
This is Clayton Doffenbaugh that we're talking with by telephone. Clayton, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Your voice is coming through from Chicago just fine.
That's good.
We're talking about creating local democracy. How did you first get interested in that whole topic?
Well, it's something I grew up believing in, I suppose. I grew up believing that in America, people were supposed to rule. And that belief over the years kind of evolved into a professional career.
And how did you first get involved professionally in trying to do that?
Well, that first started down in Champaign-Urbana and in Charleston, Illinois, where I worked for the Champaign County Health Care of Consumers for a period of time, based down in Coles County, doing some organizing work among senior citizens, primarily in Coles County, around health care reform issues.
And how did you get trained to do that? How did you learn how to do that? On the job?
Well, I learned a lot of it on the job. I've gone through some brief formal training and done a lot of reading and studying and thinking myself as well.
And in terms of what you learned, what were some of the basic principles that have guided you?
Well, that's evolved some over the years as well. I think over time, the thing I've learned the most is some very basic common sense elements about empowerment and power as it functions. One of the things is that power ultimately very genuinely does come from the people. The people don't always practice it either at all, or when they do, practice it effectively. And they oftentimes meet a lot of resistance. But in the end, power does come from people. And that's the core thing. There are also different elements or steps that I think one can go through to create local organizations that function in a democratic fashion that I've learned over the years also.
And what are some of the blocks or impediments to the power to make decisions, get things done, coming from the people in a democracy like the U.S.?
Well, there's a couple of crucial voids, I suppose, in our political structures that make it difficult for people to actually determine what's going on in their local communities and on regional and national levels as well. One of those is in our Constitution. If you read the Constitution, you'll notice that the word democracy never appears in it. And there is a reason for that, and that was because it was written in order to distance the government from the people. When the Constitution was first put together, it was in response to a very vibrant and vigorous exercise of popular authority on the part of the people across what were then the very new 13 states. And there were folks who felt that that needed to be controlled and diminished. And so the Constitution was written in order to provide institutional distance from that expression of popular sovereignty at that time. James Madison, in particular, was concerned that popular factions, particularly factions that were composed of a majority of the people, had too much say.
And it would be mob rule.
Well, that could be one way of looking at it. Another word for that, I think, is democracy. But Mr. Madison put in place a structure that made it very difficult for the majority of people to get together and influence their government, and that was done very deliberately. And so we don't have any formal institutional structures that provide for direct decisions by the people. Everything is delegated to elected representatives or bureaucracies or small private interests for decision-making. And then also, I think following on that is a lack of organizations formed by people themselves that are able to function in a truly democratic fashion. So in order to overcome the difficulties we've got, the sort of malaise, the lack of civic participation that affects the country, in the long run, we need to find a place for democracy in our Constitution. And in the short run, there are things that we can do in our own local communities to help set up democratic organizations and structures that can serve to empower people on a local level.
I want to get in our conversation over this hour, since we have the luxury of a whole hour, to both of those issues that you just raised, both the what you see as a need to somehow get concerned for a more active democracy into the Constitution, but also to deal with the whole problem of lack of current civic participation. I want to get to both of those. But before we do, why, as a community organizer who's active today in the city of Chicago and has been, as you say, in Coles County and Champaign-Urbana and other places, why do you care about the past, something like the history and the Constitution itself?
Well, it's in the past that the political structures that we operate within were established. And if you want to understand why they're set up the way they are, and from that understanding realize what the context then is in which you're operating, then you need to think about the past and so you can operate effectively in the present. If you don't study history, you're doomed to repeat it. It's kind of that philosophy for looking back over the history of the country to understand where we came from. But also, you can look back in the history of the country and learn some lessons as to how democracy does and can actually function, and get some pointers for things that you can do today.
Now, how did this happen for you? What were you doing that caused you to first start looking at the history of democracy in this country?
Well, it was just in the day-to-day grind of doing community organizing having to begin to think, as I gained more experience, to train new organizers, to train leaders in organizations, and to give them some context and some understanding, a foundation from which they could make their own decisions and evaluations for the circumstances that they were finding themselves in. So it was the need to provide, a philosophical grounding as well as a political understanding for the action that people would be contemplating and undertaking in their local communities.
So did you start doing this when you were in Coles County or in Chicago or Champaign or where?
Oh, that would have been up here in Chicago, which is where most of my career in community organizing has taken place.
And since this is one of the few radio stations that people listen to who actually do a lot of reading, what were some of the first things you read when you started doing this history?
Oh, my gosh. I read some books by Gordon Wood, who analyzed the creation of the Constitution. I read a book called Democratic Promise by Lawrence Goodwin that talked about the history of the populist movement in the 1880s and 1890s and the formation of the People's Party. I read biographies of Thomas Jefferson, those sorts of things.
Hmm. Now, let's start with, I guess, the present, and then I'd like to let you lead us back into the past as you see appropriate. But tell us some of the community organizing that you've actually been doing in Chicago.
Well, most of the work that I did do over the years in Chicago was in neighborhoods on the northwest and the southwest side of the city. These were for community organizations that were existing before I went became a community organizer, and I went to work for them. And we dealt with a number of issues, mostly tending to do with crime and community responses to that, trying to reduce it and get more governmental services to address it. Issues revolving around government services in general in the city, a number of issues regarding real estate practices as they pertain to race relations in the city of Chicago. Those were the types of issues that we addressed. And there was, over time, a methodology that was developed that we put into practice in a number of different neighborhoods across the city.
I want to ask what organizations you were part of and the names of the city areas.
When I first came to work in Chicago, I worked for the Northwest Neighborhood Federation on the northwest side. I've also spent a good deal of time working for and eventually became executive director of the Southwest Parish and Neighborhood Federation. Most recently, I worked for the Save Our City Coalition in Chicago. And those groups were part of an evolving network of organizations on the northwest and southwest sides of the cities that changed over time and involved other organizations as well. But those would be the core ones for which I worked.
Thank you. I asked for those specifically because this program is heard this time of year in Chicago as well as downstate Illinois and parts of Indiana. So I wanted people who are familiar with those areas to know. And let me let our listeners know this is a live program every Sunday afternoon here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Clayton Doffenbaugh. We're talking to him from Chicago about creating local democracy. We're eager to have listeners participate in our discussion. If you'd like to call anywhere the program is heard, you may call us free by punching 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. So 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana. Clayton, you've talked about the kind of work you were doing, the issues you were dealing with. What were your goals in these Save Our City Coalition or the various neighborhood groups you've worked with over the years?
Well, our goals were always to create a neighborhood organization that would develop leadership indigenous to the communities that the organizations were in, and that would serve to involve and represent the majority of the residents in those communities. And that was always the organizational, the empowerment goal. The issues that were worked on were an outgrowth of the interaction of the organization with the residents of the community. And so the issues were always selected by the residents, not necessarily by the leadership or the staff of the organizations. We had a very deliberate process for ensuring that it was the residents themselves who set the priorities for the organization.
We have our first caller. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Concerning the lack of direct democracy in United States government, I grew up in California where the state government has provisions in the state constitution that it can be directly amended fairly easily by a vote of them in general elections. And even though I'm sympathetic to the need for more direct democracy, it does not seem to me, looking at the state of California, that this has worked out as well as I might have wished. People tend to vote for lots of government benefits and vote against taxes and vote for property tax relief. And in general, the experience seems to have been that moneyed interests can pay people to get enough signatures to get amendments on the ballot, and then pay enough for television advertising to influence people to vote their way. And the results, to me, do not seem to be very good. I'll hang up and let your guests discuss that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question. Could you hear that all right, Clayton?
Yes. Well, not being from California, I can't speak with the same direct experience as the caller. However, the California process is an electoral process that tends to focus on specific issues that allows citizenry to have a direct vote on those particular issues. So in that case, that is a form of direct democracy. However, what it doesn't do is provide an institutional base of an ongoing nature, particularly at a local level, where people can be engaged in deliberation and decision-making over an extended period of time over issues that they themselves are selecting. So there are problems with the initiative process as instituted in Chicago or in California. We used in Chicago a referendum process that works a bit differently. It was a citizen-initiated process that we could combine, and of course in Illinois it's only advisory referenda that are allowed, but it would enable local organizations on any precinct or in any combination of adjoining precincts to put a referendum on the ballot and by collecting signatures from 10% of the registered voters. And it was specifically designed to be local so that it was the local organizations in the communities that were setting the agenda. And that type of process helps to preclude some of the difficulties that California has experienced. Part of that grows out of just being able to do it on a very local level as opposed to a statewide level. Statewide, particularly in a state the size of California, requires many more resources, which makes it subject to getting beyond the control of the people at the local level. And the caller also commented about an analysis of the quality of the decisions that were made by the people in voting. And I guess my response to that is that democracy doesn't necessarily assure that the decisions that are made are always going to be of good quality. I guess I would argue that decisions made, without democracy are not always of good quality as well, and that in the long run, we're better off having the people make the decisions to the greatest extent possible themselves because the health of the overall political culture will be greater, and it'll be able to right itself more effectively when, in fact, mistakes are recognized.
Let me follow up on the caller's issue. In terms of direct democracy, in your experience, for example, in Chicago, have there been times when you've helped people express a group of people in a neighborhood, for example, express their desires, what they want, and you really felt that what they wanted wasn't best even for them, but they didn't realize it?
Well, as a professional, I've always felt that it was my obligation to help the people come to their own decision and not to form value judgments on what it was they were doing. Of course, you always have the possibility that you'll just be in such great disagreement that you have to remove yourself from that. But fortunately, I never came to that circumstance. But I've learned a lot. When there were circumstances where I would go into it with doubts, I would usually find that there were very solid and sound reasons for why people felt the way they did. And they taught me a lot. When you work as a local organizer, you spend a lot of time in people's homes listening to them individually and in small groups. If you're open to their experience and listen carefully to what they have to say, you learn that while there may be more than one point of view on an issue, that their point of view is usually pretty legitimate.
Hmm. Can you give us an example? We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Clayton Doffenbaugh from the city of Chicago, who's a community organizer there. We're talking about how to create local democracies. And can you give us an example of in that process, what some people were trying to do?
Well, maybe I'll give two examples, if that's okay.
Please.
One sort of a very simple one, and one a more complex one. When I grew up, I played Little League baseball a lot. And one of the local issues that I worked on in a neighborhood had to do with a group of folks who wanted to prevent a Little League from opening a field in their community. And my initial reaction to that was one of some horror because, you know, I was a baseball fan, and I gained a lot from that, and I think kids, well, my kids today play baseball. And I thought there was a lot of benefit from that, and I couldn't understand why people would want to prevent kids from playing baseball in their community. But over time, I learned that the league in question that was wanting to move into their area had a history of not dealing well with the neighbors, that there were issues of noise late at night, of parking, of residents no longer being able to use a field that they had been using because they were going to be fenced out of it, and a variety of things of that sort that made me come to realize that their point of view was actually a very legitimate one, and that you know, they had real concerns that needed to be addressed. So that's the simple one.
All right.
The more complicated one has, I suppose, to do with race relations. When I came to Chicago, I worked in neighborhoods that at that time were predominantly white ethnic communities, and Chicago being what it is, race was a very hot topic, very conflictual circumstance in the city. I learned that many of these folks on the southwest and the northwest sides who had been labeled, and had in fact people in their communities participated in very racist sorts of activities, that the majority of people in those communities had very legitimate concerns that focused on institutional practices involving race. They had been victims of redlining, as had minority communities. They had been victims of things such as panic peddling, and other illegal real estate practices. Their communities had been victimized by fraud in the FHA program and things of that sort, so that they had a perspective on that issue that needed to be addressed, and it was legitimate. And I learned over the course of a number of years that dealing with real estate practices and race relations in Chicago, that minority, typically but not always African-American communities, had been greatly victimized, but that the victimization of the white ethnic communities that led to a great deal of the bitterness between those communities had often been overlooked, and that if people were going to learn to live together in the city of Chicago, that the concerns of both of those communities needed to be addressed. And so that was something that I came to Chicago with some preconceived notions of, about communities such as Marquette Park and places like that in Chicago, where I came to realize that I had a lot to learn, and that I needed to be a bit more humble and a bit more open-minded to learn from the residents of those communities. And we did a number of things over the years that helped to ease those tensions in the city.
Let me give the phone numbers to our listeners who may like to ask a question to our guest today on Keeping the Faith. Anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several lines by punching in your phone, 333-9455. We're talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh, who is a former executive director of the Save Our City Coalition in Chicago, and who has been a community organizer with several Chicago and downstate groups. We're talking about how to create local democracy and some of the blockades to that. We have a caller waiting. Let's go to line one. Who you're on the air with our guest. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi. I have two questions. One is, I wonder if this is Mother's Day, and I'm obviously a mother or grandmother. I wonder if the sex makes any difference. I want your guest to comment on that, because I know we're talking about democracy, but I noticed that James Madison is a male, and when we look at all the history of our country, they're all mostly males. But I think that's changing. So I wanted to have him comment on that issue, and I'll hang up and listen to the response. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So the question is about gender and what difference that makes in community organizing and democracy.
Well, in a truly democratic circumstance, democracy is an inclusive endeavor. If power comes from the people, if you want to build power for people, you got to include the people in what you're doing. And so any kind of structure that, over the years, women prohibited from voting, obviously you can look at slavery and so forth. All of these things are very anti-democratic structures within the country, and many of these we've overcome. Obviously, there's still progress that needs to be made. So I think just a blanket statement that democracy needs to be an inclusive process is an important response to the caller's question. Otherwise, gender, many of the leaders in the local organizations that I've worked with have been women. Some of the most effective leaders in the organizations, if not most of them. I don't have a theory as to why that is. But certainly, if we had acted in any fashion that would have excluded those people from participating in the decision-making in their communities, we would have been much worse off. Because you're automatically excluding half the talent in your community if you were to make that sort of decision. I think the lesson is, you want to include everybody if you want to be effective, and certainly from the principles of democracy, you need to be inclusive.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program for this Sunday. Sunday evening, May 9th. Let me take just a moment to let listeners know who some of the guests will be on upcoming programs. Next week, Barbara Jones, former head librarian of the Rare Book Room at the University of Illinois, will be our guest, talking about literary censorship. That's May 16, Barbara Jones. On May 23rd, we'll be replaying a program from last February that's been requested. Bill Kegel, a historian from Millikan University, will be talking about the biblical book of Revelation. And quite interesting discussion. That'll be May 23rd. On May 30, Al Sharp will be live on Keeping the Faith, also from Chicago. He's the executive director of Protestants for the Common Good, which is an organization that's set up to counter the political influence of the religious right. Al Sharp will be our guest on May 30. Those are some of the guests coming up on Keeping the Faith programs on Sundays from 5 to 6 in the weeks ahead. Here on WILL this coming week on Afternoon Magazine, there are two programs that Celeste Quinn's guest we'll be discussing topics I think might be of special interest to listeners to Keeping the Faith. On Tuesday afternoon, a little after 1, Celeste will be talking with several people about the whole notion of walking a labyrinth. A new one has been put into Crystal Lake Park, and there's a meditation garden there in connection with it. So Celeste will be talking with several people who know about that project. That's Tuesday, May 11, a little after 1. And then on Friday, about the same time. Celeste will be talking on Afternoon Magazine with Robert Thurman, who is a former Tibetan Buddhist monk. And she'll be talking about seven virtues for living well. This is also a program that was previously broadcast with Celeste, but by popular demand, we'll be replaying that this Friday. If you missed it the first time, you might like to learn about seven virtues for living well from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where I'm the executive director. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. The Y's been at the university since 1873. It was started by students and has been continuing ever since, finding ways to provide opportunities for social action and community service by students during their college years here at the university. The Y is a charity and survives because of people who believe in its mission, making contributions. We do thank people who have donated to our annual auction a couple weeks ago, people who came and purchased goods and services from others. We also are happy to receive automobiles, trucks, vans, the people wish to donate to the Y and avoid having to sell them themselves or trade them in and get a tax deduction if they itemize their taxes. We currently have two cars for sale that have been donated. One's a quite interesting older vehicle. It's 27 years old, a Lincoln Continental, two-door. About 81,000 miles, but other than the finish, is in pretty good shape mechanically. So that's an interesting vehicle. If you want to look at do a makeover on a car that's one of the last of the really large cars, call me at the Y, 337-1500. I'm Steve Shoemaker. And we also recently received a pristine 1992 Cadillac Seville. Blue leather seats, 76,000 miles, one owner, wonderfully taken care of. If you're interested in that car, give me a call, 337-1500 during the week. Let's see. Dump and Run is coming up, one of the Y's great projects. This is our third year of collecting items that students often would throw away when they leave campus. They've collected things over the year, can't get it all in their car or truck. Instead of going in the dumpster, we place huge cardboard boxes all around campus, encourage students to put reusable items of any sort in those boxes. We store them over the summer and have a huge garage sale next fall for students and others of those still useful items. Furniture, books, computers, clothes, all sorts of things. We start collecting tomorrow. If there are people in the community who have things they'd like to donate, call the Y and we can tell you when you can bring them by, 337-1500. University YMCA on the corner of Wright Street and Chalmers. Well, Clayton, thank you for your patience while I gave those little public service announcements. And now let's get back to our talk about creating local democracies. You have a book that you've put together about the Constitution, right? Tell me about that. How can people get a hold of that book if they're interested, first of all?
Well, the book does talk about the constitutional issues. It also goes into a great deal of depth about how to create democratic organizations, local democratic organizations.
What's the title?
Community and Neighborhood. It's Common Sense Democracy, How to Complete the American Revolution in Your Neighborhood.
And where may people find it?
Well, if you're interested in single copies, probably the most inexpensive way to get them is just to order them directly from me, which you can do by sending me a check at my address at 1311 South Elmwood in Berwyn, Illinois, 60402. $18.31 covers the book, the postage, and the tax. Anybody's interested in bulk copies, they are better off ordering from the publisher. And there's a website for that. It's Ex Libris. It's xlibris.com. And in the search engine, you just plug in Common Sense Democracy, and it would get you straight to a way to order the book.
And do tell us how to spell your last name, Clayton.
It's D, like in David, A-U-G-H-E-N, B, like in boy, A-U-G-H.
Clayton Doffenbaugh is the author and our guest today on Keeping the Faith, the author of Common Sense Democracy, which you can order at 1311 South Elmwood. That's Chicago, Illinois, 60402.
Actually, Berwyn,
Illinois. I'm sorry, Berwyn, you said.
B-E-R-W-Y-N.
Berwyn, Illinois. And that's $18.31 for the book and postage. So what's in the book? Why would anybody be interested?
Well, if you're interested in trying to learn how to address a problem in your community and do it from the perspective of being very democratic in the process, this would be the book for you. The definition of democracy that is expressed in the book is one that's based on people making the decisions themselves for their own community. So therefore, there's a whole process that's outlined on how you can identify issues of concerns in your community. And also part of this definition of democracy is the perspective that these decisions need to be based on demonstrated support by the majority of the voting age residents in the community. And so the book also outlines how you can go about demonstrating that support and receiving that support from the majority of people in your community, however your community is defined. So you can learn how to do all of that from this book, as well as learn about some of the constitutional issues that we discussed earlier, and learn about some of the qualities of leadership that are necessary to sustain these types of organizations beyond their initial startup that normally would be based on a single issue.
Now, you want to change the Constitution in some important ways, but one of the ways you don't want to change the Constitution is to add a marriage amendment. Tell us in what ways you want to change the Constitution and why.
Well, in his retirement, Thomas Jefferson had observed the void in the Constitution where democracy ought to be, and he developed a recommendation for how to put democracy into the Constitution. He called it the Ward Republic, and in effect, what he wanted to provide for was a structure based primarily on the township system that he had also devised and that still exists in some superficial ways across at least the Midwest, and it's also somewhat moderate after the town meeting, where people would come together and make decisions for their own local communities. And he wanted to make a provision, an institutional provision for that in the Constitution, so that the people would be involved in directly in making the decisions for local governmental issues.
Now, why wasn't Jefferson able to get that through in his day?
Well, because he had retired, and he was thinking about his career and writing letters to his colleagues and his friends, and he was no longer a practicing politician.
After all these decades and more, do you think it's possible now or worth even trying?
Well, there is no basis at this point, unfortunately, for having this sort of amendment to the Constitution. In my book, I provide a draft of what one might look like. But I suppose the honest answer to your question is right now I don't see the opportunity for this kind of amendment to the Constitution. I don't think people are sufficiently aware of even the opportunity for having this kind of direct democracy in our governing structures. And there's no organizational base for pursuing such a constitutional amendment at this point. So until that day comes, We were left to our own resources in creating our own institutions in our own communities.
Now, why isn't
most of the book is given to guidance on how to go about doing that?
Now, why isn't the elective process that's currently in place close enough to a direct democracy?
Well, every time we vote, that is an exercise in democracy because people are making the decision, and it's based on a majority rule circumstance. But once we've voted, we've given the authority to decision making over to other people, and so we're no longer engaged in a formal sense in that process. The only way in which we're able to influence decisions is by organizing and then pressuring the elected officials, but we are precluded from directly making the decisions ourselves, and so elections are basically, you know, democracy one day every 2 years, and during the rest of the time, we're left without any provisions for direct rule by the people. Now it's republics, which is what, you know, elected representatives are a good thing. Obviously, the people don't have the wherewithal or even the time to make decisions on everything that must come before a governmental body. However, those circumstances where there are high priorities, particularly on a local level, where people can more easily be directly engaged, there should be some institutional framework by which people can do that. There are all sorts of other institutions across the country that are well organized, governments that are well organized, for people to take part in directly influencing those decisions. One of the lessons I learned in organizing over the years is you're constantly starting over again. You have to create local organization where it doesn't exist. You have to sustain it without institutional basis for funding, and it's those two things are very difficult to do. And when you're going up against or engaged in a power relationship with institutions that already have a funding base, that are already pre-existing, you're starting at an automatic handicap, and so it's much more difficult for people to be effective in their participation as a result of that. So if we had some institutional basis for that, I think people would feel much better about their role as citizens in the country than they do now. People feel very powerless.
We have another caller.
They are powerless.
We have another caller waiting. Before I go to that call, let me give the numbers once again for others who might like to ask a question or make a comment. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free line in Champaign-Urbana. Local callers, 333-9455. Let's go to line one. You're on the air with our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I called earlier, and I appreciate your answer. This is a different question. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear the introduction to this speaker guest, but I gather he's been doing community organizing for quite a while.
Yes.
And I'm wondering his experience with the longevity of the groups that he helps organize. It seems often to me that what has happened is that groups can organize around a particularly hot issue, but in the long run, and this relates somewhat to what he was just talking about, the moneyed interests keep having money to pay people to deal with these issues, but the more democratic issues groups, once the hot issue kind of fades, it's hard to keep things going in a democratic way. And I wonder what his experience has been. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question.
The funding issue that the caller raises is a very critical one. It's difficult for organizations to raise the amount of money they need to provide the professional staffing, the physical infrastructure, you know, an office, the cost of communications, and that sort of thing. And so that's building. You start with a single issue, and you build people's loyalty from that. Hopefully, people learn from that experience that they can influence many other things in their community. And you have to do continuous outreach into your community to make sure that you're engaging the majority of people in that community, and so that you're always bringing in new leaders and new participants, and that people are engaged and that they feel that their concerns are being addressed. Success is important in addressing issues, because if people feel they've actually accomplished something, then they're willing to invest themselves. And from that investment of time, but of also money, they're often able to leverage additional investments. And so you have to have a multi-issue organization that's constantly outreaching across its community in order to sustain itself. And you have to win issues. And you have to be very deliberate in the process, so that people come to understand that we're not just talking about a single issue, whatever that issue is, but we're talking about setting up something that can address multiple issues and multiple concerns. And again, the book goes into some details on how you can go about doing that, starting simply on your own block. But the caller is absolutely correct. It's an inherent disadvantage. If there was an institutional basis for democracy, if it was part of our governmental structures in the Constitution, we wouldn't have to start from scratch all the time, and we wouldn't be subject to the backsliding that results from once you've won an issue or lost an issue to people getting back, you know, to their normal lives, because we're primarily talking about volunteers here, and time and resources are limited. And so finding a means to address that constitutionally would be a great asset for empowering people to make decisions directly.
And I think complicating that issue is that the moneyed interests often control much of the media, radio stations, newspapers, sources of information, and it makes people who don't have those kind of assets, or who by advertising in those kind of places and whose voices are listened to, it's very difficult for them to get a voice anywhere. We have another caller waiting on line two. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh. Line two, are you there?
I've really enjoyed your discussion on democracy.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions sort of on the to see what you think about how, you know, democratic processes can best work. And sort of one thing I'd be interested in hearing you talk about is the idea of consensus as opposed to majority rules democracy.
Okay. Well, consensus is particularly on very deeply felt issues. It's very difficult to attain. And often in where there's issues that are deeply felt, there are two sides. And there is likely to be conflict. And so I don't think that consensus is generally going to be a viable option.
Would our caller like to say something in favor of consensus while you have the air?
Well, I'm just coming at this from the perspective of I'm a member of the co-op community in Champaign-Urbana. And within co-ops and in between co-ops, we try and use consensus when possible. I think some of the co-ops use a limited consensus so that, you know, if only one or two people are blocking the consensus, they can be overridden by the rest. But we try and do that because, you know, it's, you know, with majority rules, there's the possibility that a narrow majority could, you know, impose a decision on the other, on the rest of the group, that the minority finds utterly, against their principles, and that is unacceptable, you know, to the group as a whole. So the idea behind using consensus would be that if you can't get a, you know, at least a very, very large majority, that the group shouldn't be making that decision. It should be made at some lower level, you know, with smaller groups, so that, you know, the people who think one way can, you know, try and work towards that on their own, and then the other groups can do the same with their opinions.
Well, I think in the example that you cite, the smaller and more homogeneous the organization is, the more likely it is to be able to attain consensus. And within that type of organization, to strive towards that might very well be a wise thing. I was addressing the situation more from the standpoint of a community-wide sort of concern. And one of the reasons that I emphasize majority decision-making so much is that most of the decisions that are made community-wide or societal decisions are often made based on factional interests. And the people in general and the majority of people in particular often do not get a say in that process. So if you're talking about a community of several thousand people, and the governmental structures are not set up to engage those people in the decision-making process, then a local organization that would strive to make its decisions majority-based would actually be incorporating many more people into the process and getting their point of view represented than exists most typically in most of our towns and cities these days.
I want to thank the caller for raising that important issue about the consensus. We do have another caller waiting, and we're approaching the end of our time, so let's go quickly to line one and try to squeeze in another comment or question. Go ahead, please.
This is a quick comment. I was trained as a political scientist, though I no longer work in the field, and I will just echo what your guest said about consensus. Consensus is incredibly conservative. It's very hard to get any change to happen in it. And if you think about who typically has the system set up, you know, if the moneyed interests are the guys who have the system rigged in their favor, they love consensus because then nothing happens, which is what they want. So I think the basic comments that it's works in small groups but not in large ones is right on.
Appreciate that comment. Thank you very much. Any response, Clayton?
No, I tend to agree with what he said. I mean, I think in small groups it can be a good thing to strive for, but in societal circumstances it's generally not possible, and those special interests, you're never going to get their consensus.
Let's end with one philosophical question that you raised earlier, really, about James Madison. Why was he so afraid of giving the power directly to the people? Do you think he had any reason for that?
Well, I think he was a person who was used to being in the elite that was making the decisions, and he found that threatened. And there was a lot of other people in those circumstances. And so he attempted to set up a system where the majority would remain divided, but yet would the freedoms of speech and of religion and of the press and so forth that had been put in place would still be protected. And so he sought a compromise. And the Constitution reflects that compromise, and one of the prices that we pay is that people are not able to directly determine what's going to happen in their communities. And in the long run, as our institutions grow larger and more distant, that participation gets more difficult, And ultimately, what will happen is that the people will be unable to determine what's going on, will not want to participate, and the quality of our lives will be diminished. And I think that there's a general sense of that across the country. And there's lots of scholars that have studied to try and assess what it is, why people feel that way. But very few people have studied the Constitution from the perspective of how it shuts people out. And that needs to be done if we're going to end this malaise, this civic malaise that exists in the country, this feeling, you know, that you can't fight City Hall.
And in our last minute and a half, why do you think the people can be trusted?
Because that's what the human animal is. We're a social animal. And that's the way we function. And if we're going to be healthy, then we need to be able to be effective in our lives. And if we're precluded from being effective, then we're just not going to be as happy. We're not going to be as healthy.
Tell us one more time the title of your book.
Common Sense Democracy.
And the subtitle?
How to Complete the American Revolution in Your Neighborhood.
How to Create Democracy Where You Live. It's available for $18.31 from the author at 1311 South Elmwood in Berwyn, Berwyn, Illinois, 60402.
Yes.
If people are interested in buying it in quantity, they may contact the publisher at the website exlibris.com, E-X-L-I-B-R-I-S. .com.
There's no E on the beginning.
I'm sorry. It's just X, a big X.
Yes.
Sorry. I wrote it down incorrectly. Ex Libris. Great. I want to thank our many callers today during Keeping the Faith, and of course our guest Clayton Doffenbaugh, who is a community organizer and previous executive director of the Save Our City Coalition in Chicago, and a former organizer for Champaign County Healthcare Consumers at one point. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, Barbara Jones will be talking about literary censorship. She is a librarian, formerly with the Rare Book Room at the University of Illinois Library. Coming up on May 23rd, Bill Kegel, an archive program talking about the biblical book of Revelation from the perspective of a historian. On May 30, Al Sharp, Protestants for the Common Good. A reminder that the University YMCA will be receiving all kinds of things ordinarily thrown away that are still usable this time of year, either at the Y or in our various dump-and-run boxes around the community. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
For Mother's Day this year, we asked a few moms to share the plain, unvarnished truth about life with kids. Motherhood isn't all sexy stars on the covers of magazines. It's also baby throw-up, poopy diapers, and sulky teenagers. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the joys of motherhood for real. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriFab Incorporated, Sullivan, Anderson Foundation, Body Works Associates, Champaign, and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a small chance of showers and thunderstorms in the evening. The low in the lower 60s with southwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. The high in the mid-80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low in the lower 60s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.